when we looked at all these different candidates, all of them had described themselves as unapologetically or unwaveringly pro-life and standing on the side of life. But when it came down to actually looking a bit deeper at their positions on abortion and actual policy, that's when we really found that differences started to show.
You're listening to the USSC Briefing Room, a podcast from the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney, where we give you a seat at the table for a USSC briefing on the latest developments in US news and foreign policy. We'll cover what you need to know and what's beneath the surface of the news.
Welcome to another episode of the Briefing Room at the US Study Center. My name is Jared Monshine. I am the Director of Research at the US Study Center. And today I am joined by Ava Kalinauskas and Sam Garrett, who are research associates in the Politics, Society, and Culture program, which I also head up at the US Study Center. But before we get started, I first want to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose lands we are recording today and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. So today I am joined by two stellar research associates who have recently published something called Trump's VP Shortlist, What Australians Should Know. Now, personally, as someone who has to cover US politics here, it's been a bit boring. There hasn't been that many questions on the Republican or Democratic side for who would be their party's nominee for some months. I mean, Trump won Iowa back in January, a couple months ago. And then he also had a commanding lead in the polling for, you know, basically a year at this point amongst GOP voters. And there really wasn't too much of a question on Joe Biden and Democrats as well. So the one question I've had now for many months is who will join Trump on his ticket in 2024. We know back in 2016, he got Mike Pence from Indiana to join him. And Mike Pence not only gave him some credibility from the Midwest, given that he was both a member of Congress and a governor of Indiana, but he was also a very fervent evangelical Christian. And that really solidified Trump's ties with the evangelical Christian and his credibility with the evangelical Christian base. As well, I don't think Trump has that problem in 2024 in terms of needing to sort of establish his credibility with them. If anything, he's trying to go in a different direction. And I want to discuss this direction for 2024 with these excellent research associates who have published now some 13,000 words in this report or in this write-up on who will be on Trump's shortlist. Now, I first, before we get started, want to confirm that Ava and Sam, you have a stat or a fact to share with us at the end of the episode?
Sure do.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. So now that we have that confirmed, I just want to maybe get a lay of the land. Could you maybe just explain what is this report or how did you organize it? And maybe how many different candidates are you looking at altogether?
So we looked at a whole different range of kind of potential VP picks for Trump, people who had indicated interest, people who Trump might have hinted at himself, and we broadly classified them into three different groups. So some of the different types of potential candidates we came across, we've branded are the loyalists, the presidential dropouts, and the wildcards. So to start with, we looked at Elise Stefanik, who is representing a congressional district in upstate New York in the House currently. We also looked into Kristi Noem, who was in the South Dakotan House and then the federal House and is now South Dakota governor since 2019. And our final loyalist we looked into was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who was actually Trump's White House press secretary from 2017 to 2019. And now she is the governor of Arkansas.
So the second category were presidential dropouts. So those are people who are running against Trump for the 2024 presidential nomination, which, you know, Trump is now already the presumptive nominee, but these are people who ran unsuccessfully against him for that position. First of those being Senator Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, Vivek Ramaswamy, the entrepreneur, and as an outside chance, Nikki Haley, who stayed in the race the longest against Trump and was his former ambassador to the UN during Trump's first presidential administration. And also governor of South Carolina. So, you know, these presidential dropouts, like every election cycle, we often see people who unsuccessfully seek the nomination are often top contenders for a running mate. You know, Joe Biden himself, you know, ran unsuccessfully in 2008, but dropped out and then obviously became vice president and since become president. So that's often the pool of people that is certainly high on the list, these sorts of shortlists to be vice presidential nominees.
And the final category we looked at was wildcards. So we know that Trump can be quite unpredictable when he comes to making these sorts of choices. So these were people who might have less formal government experience or come from different backgrounds, but that would potentially interest him for different reasons. So we looked into Carrie Lake, who you might remember from her failed governor campaign in Arizona in 2022. She famously described herself as Trump in a dress. So the two have remained quite close, but she's currently going back for a Senate seat. So we looked into her. Toni Ernst is another wild card that we had a look at. She had a long military career, but she's since represented Iowa in the Senate and is currently quite high up as the third ranking Republican Senate member in the US. So she has spoken, I think, a lot more extensively on alliances in Asia. So she'd be a more traditional, perhaps, focus for Trump when it comes to picking someone with more government experience and more foreign policy experience. And then the final wildcard we looked at was J.D. Vance, who is a very recent senator, the newest senator in Ohio. He only started last year. And he rose to prominence in 2016 with his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and has had an interesting sort of conversion story when it comes to Trump. He was quite critical of him in 2016, but has since become quite a strident supporter. But those are the wildcards that Trump could potentially be choosing from.
Now, you've listed 9 altogether candidates in this list, and they're all pretty different. Though I think there seem to be some similarities, or at least some key themes that you can point to across all of the options you listed so far. What would you say are some of them from your perspective?
I think one of the key themes to me was, you know, when you look deep on their foreign policy views. You know, a lot of them have got, I guess, more developed foreign policy views than others, particularly if they've spent time in internationally engaged roles, such as, you know, Nikki Haley's ambassadorship, or if you're Tim Scott sitting on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or, you know, others such as Kristi Noem, who've approached foreign policy more from a sort of state-based perspective because they've been governors of various states. So they've all sort of dabbled to different degrees in you know, how foreign policy, and in how they've engaged with these issues. But I think one of the key through lines to me has been that even though they do differ on some of their policy positions, foreign policy, particularly if you look at positions on Ukraine funding and further aid from the US to Ukraine, but one of the through threads was really their positions on China. So a lot of these people have really spoken about the Asian alliances, the importance of Asian alliances to U.S. national interests as a way of being able to compete with China. And so even though a lot of these people have different personal journeys in terms of how they've come to you know, support Trump politically, they still have different views on things like free trade and Ukraine, but their general approach to China being, you know, what they say is a dangerous existential threat, some of them have said, or as, you know, a top national priority. All of them, somewhere or another, have been involved in either advocacy or legislation that seeks to address competition with China as one of the top sort of national security concerns.
Ava, did you notice any other themes across all the candidates or options? Instead of candidates, they're not official candidates.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would totally agree with Sam. And I would also say that one other dynamic that I'll definitely be watching is how the issue of abortion could potentially play into Trump's decision of who he wants to run with as a VP. It's reported that he's quite sensitive to this policy issue at the moment, and it could potentially factor into his decision about, like, choosing a woman, for example. One thing we did find is that when we looked at all these different candidates, all of them had describe themselves as unapologetically or unwaveringly pro-life and standing on the side of life. But when it came down to actually looking a bit deeper at their positions on abortion and actual policy, that's when we really found that differences started to show. So some might think that abortion should be decided at state level. Others think it's okay to have some kind of federal minimum or national blanket ban. And they also differ quite drastically in terms of the terms and the limits that they'd set on these abortion policies, whether they think there should be exceptions with things like the life of the mother is at risk. So that was definitely something that stood out. And I think as Trump tries to navigate this very sensitive issue, it could be interesting to watch. He was obviously is really trying to take credit and was quite celebratory about the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision in 2022. But he's definitely become more cautious as he starts to view abortion and the prospect of a federal ban as slightly more of an electoral liability for him. So we know from polling that most Americans are against some kind of federal, national abortion ban, and that abortion referendums in states even like Kentucky, Kansas, Ohio have come out overwhelmingly in the side of abortion rights ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned. So this is obviously the first presidential election since the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade. And it will be interesting to see how Trump navigates the messaging around abortion, how it might factor into his decision making, whether he'll be looking quite closely at these candidates and their, or their potential options and their records on abortion and the optics of choosing different options.
You said they've had a journey. You've looked at their policies. In terms of them as people, what do you think, like, what unites them? What do you see as the, you talked about their policy positions, but as just as vice presidents, what do you see them as bringing to the ticket, or if not bringing to the ticket, as just what unites them in terms of their personality? Or is there anything that you see there that is a common theme throughout these options for Trump?
I think one of the common themes has really just been their personal and political journeys in terms of how they've come to relate to Trump, and the fact that a lot of them have really basically quite clearly flipped on their positions on Trump. They've really moved from being much more sort of conventional Republicans in the past to, as Trump has grown in his political power, really come onto the political scene in the last couple of years, that they've really sought to align themselves much, much more closely with him. So, you know, if you look at some of them used to be very critical of him, people like Elise Stefanik, also J.D. Vance, you know, once described himself as a never Trump kind of guy. Whereas others, you know, Ava mentioned Lake's comment about being Trump in a dress, you know, quite explicitly styling their public and political personas on Trump, on his rhetoric, his positions on issues, really trying to mirror that. So, you know, whether it's been in a kind of jarring shift or in a long sort of drift, they've all kind of, I guess, had a different sort of story in terms of how they've come to mirror Trump or mimic him in some cases. But all of them have sort of gone on that sort of path to really sort of align themselves with him.
Now, in terms of what we do at the City Center, we do a lot of deep dives like this on a lot of different issues, whether it be key issues to look at in the election, you know, understand the Electoral College or how, you know, different states do their primary votes. But the number one thing we get asked to do, and at least I get asked to do, is just to give people a very quick, who do you think is going to win? So I'm not going to ask you who's going to win, but I am going to ask you, who do you think are the most likely one or two candidates for Trump to consider that you think are the most likely that he will consider adding them to the ticket for 2024?
Yeah, I could potentially start. So I think that two people to watch will be Kristi Noem and Elise Stefanik. We both categorize them both as loyalists. Kristi Noem especially has really been in the headlines and is widely seen as a front runner for the VP role. As Sam mentioned, she has essentially styled her political career more recently on Trump's rhetoric and Trump's policy gripes. So she has been governor for a few years, and she really rose to prominence during the pandemic from mirroring his rhetoric around things like mask mandates. And she's someone who would very likely remain in lockstep with Trump's policy agenda if she were to be chosen as his VP. So I imagine that she could be someone who is quite appealing to Trump. Another one is Elise Stefanik, who, as Sam mentioned, has undergone this kind of interesting conversion story. She's sort of seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, and she was originally quite moderate and was quite critical of Trump in 2016. She criticized his comments about women. She voted against his signature domestic tax cuts in 2017. But she's undergone this kind of redemption arc, I guess, in his eyes, to now become a really strident supporter of Trump and his agenda. She's described herself as ultra MAGA and proud, and she's done lots of backflips on policy issues like climate, which suggest that if she was his vice president and they were elected, that there's a very high chance that she'd continue to shift in line with Trump. So I definitely say Kristi Noem and Elise Stefanik are interesting ones just because of their loyalty agenda that would make them quite attractive to him, I believe. Also, the fact that they're women could be something that he's interested in if he's looking to kind of target different demographics. Elise Stefanik is also a little younger, which could be a consideration for him.
Sam?
Yeah, I think, I mean, those two are definitely ones to watch. So probably the third one that constantly comes up is Tim Scott. You know, he's the only Black Republican in the Senate. And, you know, even though he's mostly known for his 2024 presidential campaign, which, you know, didn't pick up a lot of support. And, you know, during the campaign, he took a pretty optimistic tone in his sort of rhetoric, which contrasted a lot with the way Trump's kind of been using rhetoric in this election. But he's really become sort of a front-running candidate alongside Noem in particular. A large part of that reason being his potential to help Trump win support from Black voters, which is a key target for Trump's campaign. It's been a demographic that Biden's support has really been slipping in the last 4 years. And, you know, Scott was actually elected as a Tea Party candidate to Congress back in 2010 before he was appointed to the Senate in 2012. By Nikki Haley, exactly. But he's, you know, become seen as something of a more moderate or at least more conventional Republican candidate than Trump, while still, you know, effectively being very loyal and sort of, you know, supportive of Trump both during his presidential his own presidential primary campaign and since Scott dropped out. You know, the other one I would probably mention, would be Nikki Haley herself. Not because she's necessarily a particularly likely candidate to get chosen by Trump. You know, she was very much on the front foot on attacking Trump during the presidential primary campaign. But, you know, she's explicitly said that she doesn't want to be vice president to Donald Trump. But her name keeps still being sort of floated as a potential option as a kind of unifying candidate because of her wider appeal amongst independent voters and moderate Republicans who'd sort of been considering a different option to Trump, which is a sizable minority of the Republican Party. And so I think that really just goes to show the sorts of considerations that go into these vice presidential picks, where they're often chosen because of demographic reasons or to deliver a particular state, or to help cover what's seen as potential weaknesses of the leading candidate. And so even when they really like deny interest and have like pretty sort of belligerent history with the nominee, they're sort of still seen as kind of an outside chance as a possible contender.
All right. One last question before we get to the stats, and that is, it's in the title, What Australians Should Know. What do you think is, you know, having looked at not only the U.S. electoral process and just how convoluted it can be at times, but also done deep dives into both the GOP candidates as well as the VP options, when Australians when an Australian on the street stops you and says, you know, what should I know about Trump's running mates, what would you say is the most important for Australia to take away from this?
I would say that, you know, one, as we said before, that despite their, you know, different backgrounds and sometimes different views, they're generally very consistent on being supportive, if not of Australia, but at least of the region more generally, which is perhaps surprising for some people. And also, I would say that they should understand that, you know, this pick is unusual. Because loyalty has been particularly highly prized as a quality of these candidates. You know, you never want to pick a vice presidential running mate who isn't going to be, you know, supportive of the ticket, obviously. But I think particularly for Trump, you know, he's not looking for sort of a, you know, a co-campaigner or someone that can help him kind of run the administration. He's looking for, you know, a face that can sort of be in the background, and be a loyal pick, and for him to avoid sort of repeating what Trump sees as the mistake of picking Mike Pence in his last administration, which he now sees as as having, you know, sort of stymied a lot of what he wanted to do in his first time around as president.
I would agree. And I would also say that what comes into the loyalty pick as well is that the VP could potentially be someone with just not much governing experience and who hasn't spoken extensively on foreign policy. So there were lots of candidates like Kari Lake and even Ramaswamy to an extent who just didn't have very strongly developed kind of foreign policy perspectives or instances of, I guess, like policy records and issues that they'd spoken about historically that we could point to and say would likely guide them in office. So I think if loyalty is the kind of governing dynamic of how he's going to be choosing someone, it does make for a very interesting situation.
Great. Now, can I ask each of you to give us your stats or your fact that you think is most relevant to this topic?
My number would be 9. There's been 9 times where the vice president has succeeded to the presidency because the president either died in office or because they resigned. So, you know, 9 vice presidents out of 49 of them becoming president. You know, it's not necessarily probable that that they become president, but there's a pretty good, significant chance that even though the vice president's often seen as, you know, not particularly important, that they could in fact suddenly be thrust into office as president of the United States. And I think particularly when you look at this election, when you've got the 2 oldest ever candidates going up up against each other, you know, there's a not insignificant chance that one or the other of them wouldn't complete their presidential term if they were elected. And so these vice presidential picks this time around will be particularly important. And we know that voters are also considering that in terms of how they view these presidential tickets, because there is a higher than usual chance that these vice presidents could succeed to the presidency.
Ava, do you have a stat?
Yeah, I do have a stat. My number is 3, which is the number of major party vice presidential nominees in U.S. history who have been women. So Kamala Harris is obviously the first woman to hold the role, but there are 2 other women in U.S. history who have ran for the role of VP. So if we cast our minds back to 2008, when Sarah Palin was John McCain's running mate and obviously lost to Barack Obama, she was 2nd. And if we cast our minds even further back to 1984, it was Geraldine Ferraro who was actually the first woman to ever be nominated for the role of VP on the Democratic ticket with Walter Mondale, which was another losing ticket. But so 3 women in history to ever have been nominated for a major party vice presidential role. It'll be interesting to see if this year we see another woman be put up for the job.
Thank you so much, Sam and Ava. Yeah, I think this deep dive is really good for Australians to read, as you said, Sam, to get an understanding of where they are on China and alliances. But also, as you said, Ava, not many... in a lot of instances, they don't have very robust views on these issues. They are maybe, you know, towing the party line in these things, but a lot of it is still to be determined. But with all that said, let's not forget that the first 2 years of Kamala Harris, her tenure as vice president, basically saw her glued to the Senate for breaking up tie-breaking votes. And I'm not sure if the Senate's going to end up in another tie in 2024, but it goes to show you that the office of the vice presidency and the role is worth more than just, as one vice president said, a warm bucket of spits. Although they might change what the bodily function is in that quote from time to time. So thank you so much for this excellent deep dive into this. I encourage our listeners to read this really impressive write-up on our website, usc.edu.au, and stay tuned for more, because we are going to be updating this, if I'm not mistaken. So next ones to be added to this list will include Tulsi Gabbard, who is now not in Congress, but is still relevant, given that she often guest-hosted for Tucker Carlson on Fox News. And then we also have Byron Donalds, who is a member of Congress from Florida. So please stay tuned, and we'll update this as the list continues to change. No matter what happens moving forward, we know that Donald Trump will make sure that this is an entertaining and exciting sort of race to be nominated.
As we wrap up, I'd like to point out a couple of other podcasts that may be of interest. Our CEO, Dr. Michael Green, is co-host of the Asia Chessboard podcast with Jude Blanchett, the Freeman Chair for China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'd also recommend checking out our USSC Live podcast series that runs recordings from our major live events, including the panel discussions from the inaugural Sydney International Strategy Forum. You can find these on our website, ussc.edu.au, or wherever you get your podcasts.